You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 28th of January 2022 on Monocle 24.
The latest from Monocle's team in Ukraine. Analysis of the global reaction to the war, which everybody but Ukraine seems to expect, and the view from the front lines of the Donbass. I'm Andrew Miller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in today's heavily Ukraine-themed show, we'll have voices from Kiev.
Every gap, every our mistake becomes an opportunity to attack.
And Ukraine's ambassador to the UK drops by Midori House.
So there are other things we're doing with the UK right now and the rest of the world. We are just normal nation trying to survive with a bigger and quite aggressive neighbor.
Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and first we head to the heart of Ukraine's capital, to Independence Square, the site of the 2013-14 Euromaidan movement, to meet journalist and fellow at the Centre for European Policy Analysis, Olga Tokariuk. As a light snowstorm flurries, Monocle's Paige Reynolds asks Olga about the international media attention on Ukraine and whether Kiev and its residents are ready for what's next.
I'm happy that a lot of international media are now coming, you know, and covering events from the ground, because I think it's essential to get the feeling here and also to hear what Ukrainians have to say. So I'm happy about that. And well, in general, me, as probably all Ukrainians or most of Ukrainians, was feeling more anxious in the recent weeks compared to even like the last year to December, because the reports of Russian military buildup on the Ukrainian border have been coming in, and there is the diplomacy doesn't seem that it provided, you know, that it led to any like breakthrough. But at the same time, you know, like, what can we do? Like, we continue to try to live our normal lives, like work, send children to school, hang around with friends on the weekends. But what like has changed for me, like in tangible terms? Well, yeah, I didn't pack like a go bag, but I prepared, like, I put all my documents and some cash and some family photos in one place just to have them ready. I also asked my husband whether our car is repaired and is ready for a long trip in case we have to make one, and we have a chance to make it. We created this small group, a chat with our friends, like with my friends, with my girlfriends, where, you know, we also share like information and we discuss. Because it somehow helps to feel that you're not alone, you know, that like with all your anxiety and everything. And actually, it's very interesting. I was thinking about like how different it feels now, this threat, and how similar it feels to what we felt in 2013 and 2014. I mean, we as Kyiv citizens, obviously, like I have never had experienced directly what war is, unlike like many Ukrainians who have been affected directly, who had to flee. We have more than 1 million internally displaced persons who had to flee from the occupied Crimea and occupied Donbass after the war started. But I personally have never experienced that. So the closest experience to something like some turmoil, like violence, was what was happening in the last days of Maidan protests here in February 2014, when the police and special forces were killing protesters. And I remember that feeling, on the one hand, like of fear, but on the other hand, of determination that, okay, you know, they're trying to kill us, like they are trying to suppress us, but it will just lead, and this confidence I felt that it will just lead like to further mobilization and unity. And I think a lot of like people are feeling that now, like we are facing a huge threat, an existential threat, maybe, from Russia. So it's not like now it's much larger scale threat, but I think what it leads to, it doesn't lead to like panic or fear. It leads to determination and to the feeling that, you know, we are not going to give up, like we are going to fight, and it unites people in their anger, actually. Because my main reaction to what is happening, like to all this concentration of Russian troops, to all the statements that are coming out of the Kremlin, basically menacing, you know, to destroy Ukraine if the West doesn't accept Putin's demands, like completely ridiculous demands that cannot be accepted. So what I feel here is a huge anger, because like what I want to do, I want to have a normal life, to, you know, raise my child, to do work that I love to do, to travel, to make plans. But instead, you know, I have to prepare a go bag and look for routes to escape from Kyiv and check whether there are bomb shelters close to my house. So, as I said, it doesn't like make me filled with fear, but rather with anger and with determination that, you know, like, I don't know, I'll do what I can. Like, of course, like I'm not, probably I won't like go to the front line because I don't see myself like taking the arms and fighting, but I'll do as a journalist what I can, you know. Like, information and words are my weapon. Like, I will do what I can to spread the information of what is going on in Ukraine, to talk to people all over the world, to explain to them what's happening. So that's somehow my way to fight.
I'm interested that you touched on a few things. You said, you know, you've got a bag ready to go. You have actually checked out whether there are some bomb shelters. What do you think the level of sort of civilian preparedness is, or urban preparedness is, right here in Kyiv right now?
I don't think this level is very high, because I think most people still don't believe that Putin can attack Kyiv. He might try to attack maybe in Donbass or in the southern Ukraine. But I think it's not very likely that he will try to seize Kyiv or to bomb Kyiv. So I think like most of the people don't take the prospect of him targeting Kyiv seriously. However, nothing can be excluded, and we still have to be prepared. And I know that like people and my friends, we were checking whether there are like bomb shelters close to our houses and whether they are open. And unfortunately, many of them are not. So they are closed, and I am somehow concerned that maybe our authorities are not doing enough to prepare for any eventualities. Because like, okay, he might attack now, he might not, he might still attack in the future. And he actually attacked Ukraine back in 2014. So the war has been going on. It's just that here in Kyiv, maybe we didn't feel it that much. So I think like it's anyway like good to be prepared. And I hope that the local authorities here in Kyiv will like also, you know, do their job.
It's interesting you say that maybe the local authorities aren't doing that much. We've spoken about the fact that there are some sort of more civilian run or sort of guerrilla style things happening where, you know, people can get trained in urban survival. How much of that are you seeing at the moment? Your friends who are signing up to this kind of thing?
If we're talking about territorial defense units, then some of them existed even before. It's just that there is like now a surge of interest in the population to join these units. And also the a new law is in force since January in Ukraine that like legalizes these formations and basically makes them a part of the armed forces. So they are reservists and they are like training in the weekends, but they are regular like civilian population who do their other daily jobs like doctors or IT professionals or teachers or whatever. But then during the weekend, they just go to this outskirts of Kyiv and they train with mock arms to repel any sort of like attack on their cities. So I have actually some colleagues, journalists from the occupied areas, from Luhansk region that has been like occupied by Russian forces since 2014, who joined these territorial defenses units even before. So when I attended these drills in December, I met him there. So it was a very like, a pleasant meeting, and I didn't know like he was a part of the territorial defense. So I think people who have a direct experience of war, they maybe, you know, like thinking about it, like that it might happen to them. Because I think like people who have never like seen war with their own eyes, they tend to be in denial. And I also, you know, like sometimes I catch myself, like I don't want to know what war is like, you know. I don't want to have this experience. So maybe we tend to underestimate the threat a little bit because we don't want this to happen. So we just want, you know, to say to ourselves, okay, this is not going to happen. But people who were there, like who saw it, and they know this can happen and your life can change overnight. They've been joining these units even before. But now more people are joining. So even those who don't have like war experience, but who follow the news and who think that the threat is really getting like bigger and Kyiv can be targeted or other Ukrainian like cities and parts of Ukraine can be targeted, they are now joining this territorial defense units. And I'm impressed that I met a lot of women at these drills when I went there as a reporter, you know, to make a report. I met a lot of women, and some women in their 50s, because you can join territorial defense up until the age of 60. So even people who are in their 50s, you know, like who have children, like who are already grown ups, who have their houses, who have a garden, they are now like training in the territorial defense units. So that's remarkable, because it really means that not just young men in Ukraine are ready to, you know, resist, that it really comprises like all social strata, different genders, different age groups. So something like a mobilization, something similar as we've seen like at the protests here in Maidan. And actually, coming back to Maidan, what I wanted to say, you know, it's, I was thinking like and talking with my friends about this thing, that when there was like also this very tense situation during the protests, because there were several attempts of the Yanukovych government, the former president who then fled to Russia, to crack down on protesters. So it was not like just one attempt in the end of February when it actually, like, when they killed protesters, about 100 of protesters. There were a few attempts before. And still, you know, when we felt like this threat that they might like come here and start like shooting, we didn't like run away from Maidan. Like, it's something when you felt like fear or you felt like anxiety, you were just like had a place, you came here and you saw like these people, so many people from like all over Ukraine camping here in freezing temperatures, you know, who were helping each other, so many volunteers bringing them food, bringing them warm clothes, just like coming here like Kyiv residents to talk to people who are camping and staying here all the time, like just to express their support and to express their gratitude and to express that we are all united and are fighting for the common cause. It was like a place where you felt low, you came here and you like recharged your batteries and you were filled, you know, with energy and with faith that eventually like we will prevail and this like protest will prevail and they strive to have Ukraine closer to the European Union, democratic, modern, free of corruption country, that like people who want it, they will prevail, because that's what this protest was all about. And now like I somehow like even regret that we don't have this place, you know, where we could all like come and unite and deal with our anxieties and share like our thoughts. So it's all like, in a way, like we're watching all this threat virtually. Now it's going on online in the media. Like we are seeing like these scary images. We're seeing like hearing scary news. So it, like what an option like for me, what I saw like a solution in this, just like to create this close group of friends to meet regularly and to talk like regularly, to share like also our thoughts and our anxieties. Because I think like what we should do is should like really stick together and to feel that we are not alone, you know, that we are like united.
That was Olga Tokariuk speaking to Monocle's Paige Reynolds earlier today in Kyiv. Now, staying in Ukraine, while Russia's recent build-up along Ukraine's borders looks extremely old school and may be designed to give exactly that appearance, the reality is that Russia has been waging a newfangled, multidimensional, postmodern hybrid campaign against Ukraine for at least 8 years. The other member of Monocle's team currently in Kyiv, Chris Chermak, spoke earlier to Lyuba Tsibulska, a hybrid warfare expert, head of the Center for Strategic Communications and Information Security under the Ministry of Culture of Ukraine and an advisor to the Foreign Ministry and Army. A woman of many talents, she also helps run her popular family-owned food and drinks establishment Zigzag in Kyiv's Old City, which will explain the background noise that any keen-eared listeners may be wondering about. Chris began by asking Lyuba about the nature of the Russian disinformation campaign.
What we see, Russia is using a tactic of using internal vulnerabilities. So every gap, every our mistake becomes an opportunity to attack. So sometimes it's not that Russia promotes some pro-Russian narratives here. No, they just use any opportunity to polarize our society with our internal, our existing problems. And this is basically one of the major threats we face, because polarization of the society is something that makes us weaker and something that set ground for the Kremlin to attack.
And talk about then a bit, how do you go about confronting that? You said as in various roles that you've had, you have been working on this since 2014. What have you learned, I suppose? What has improved in terms of how Ukraine goes about challenging this Russian disinformation campaign and confronting it?
I learned that we should have our own narrative, positive narrative. Otherwise, Russia will come and fill this vacuum with their narratives, right? And we cannot just debunk disinformation. It is very important to detect and debunk disinformation, but we also have to suggest something else. And we have to tell our people and the world our own story. Otherwise, Russia does it for us, and this is dangerous.
One, is there a difference within the Ukraine in terms of regions and where the focus is, sort of maybe Kiev urban versus rural areas that are maybe more susceptible, or of course particularly perhaps eastern Ukraine and those areas? How do you combat, or is there a way to try and combat the narrative within Ukraine?
The fact is that Ukraine is quite different. Like, our regions have different peculiarities, and sometimes even different language. You know, we speak Ukrainian and we speak Russian, we speak Hungarian, we speak Yiddish, we speak a lot of different languages here. And of course, those who are closer to our borders with Russia or to the front line, they are considered a bit more influenced by Russia. But at the same time, we see that those regions that are close to Hungary, they are quite targeted by the Kremlin as well. We detect a lot of information operations there. And the idea behind this also to divide us with our neighbor, either it's Poland or it's Hungary. So it's sort of beneficial for Russia to create these small conflicts in the regions to show that Ukraine is divided, that it has a lot of different conflicts, internal conflicts, and also external conflicts with other neighbors, because then it would be much more difficult for us to get into NATO or European Union, and generally we will be much weaker geopolitically.
Is there anything different about this moment? Have you seen either scaled up attempts by Russia and in the hybrid war space, if you will, over the last few months? Or are you preparing, doing anything differently with all of this international chatter at the moment?
First of all, we see that information operations have intensified in the last few weeks. We have a lot of messages which are aiming at spreading panic. These messages are going through social media mostly. Even my mom recently got a message saying that the war is coming, Russia is going to invade, be aware of this, and things like that. So of course the idea is to spread this chaos. And also we see a lot of messages about bombs in our schools and university, about mining. And imagine, it's massive. Like, some schools in some cities, they even switched online schooling, because basically every day they got messages about mining, about bombs. And of course it's not something new, but and sometimes even, you know, some pupils and students do it. But in our case, first of all, it's not just schools and universities who get these messages, but also all other agencies across the country, but also our special forces. They detect where these messages are coming from, and they see that they're coming either from Russia or Belarus.
One other aspect aside from disinformation is cyber warfare. Just talk a little bit about that, what Ukraine has been facing. Has that also been scaled up in the last few weeks and months?
Yes, absolutely. It's scaled up enormously. We face a lot of cyber attacks, like our government service, e-service called DIA. There was an attempt to discredit it. And the Kremlin said that there was some, you know, some leaks from DIA, it means that personal data of our citizens were leaked, which is quite dangerous, right? Cyber attacks on different levels, like regional levels and governmental levels, and what we all are preparing ourselves for is that we might have some attacks on the infrastructure combined with cyber attacks, and it will give us the feeling that the war has started and it will cause panic. So, from what I heard from different security people in our government, there is a high risk of this situation, that they will attack infrastructure and combine it with cyber attacks, and people will not be able to pay with it, with cards, with bank cards, the banking system will not work. And for instance, especially, and then people might not have electricity or something like this, and it will cause, of course, panic. And this is exactly what the Kremlin wants.
There has been so much about disinformation, misinformation all around the world in this moment, in the United States, in Europe, various groups, not just in that sense combating Russian misinformation, but all forms, whether it's vaccines, politics. With Ukraine being in some ways on the front lines of that effort, having this up-close experience of it for the last 8 years and before that as well, are there any lessons that you've learned that you feel would apply to other countries in their efforts to fight disinformation?
A lot of countries think that aggressor and aggressor, either it's Russia or China or some other countries, they will promote their narratives. You know, they will promote some very specific narratives, basically advertising themselves in your country. But at the same time, we see that it doesn't work like this. What they want is to use, take advantage of your vulnerabilities. Then you will start argue with each other. And that's what an aggressor needs. Because if you are arguing internally, your attention is on this internal conflict. You don't pay any attention to what's going on next to you, who is going to attack you, right? And this is a great opportunity for an aggressor to use it. And that's what Russia has been doing with Ukraine, putting a lot of efforts in destabilizing Ukraine, in undermining trust to our government, our institutions, especially the institutions, because the main idea of the main narrative basically Russia spread all over the world is that Ukraine is a failed state. What is failed state? This is the state that cannot govern itself, that the state that has very weak institutions. Once Putin convinced other states about this, then it's much easier for him to take control over Ukraine.
That was Lyuba Cybulska, head of Ukraine's Center for Strategic Communications and Information Security, speaking to Monocle's Chris Chermak in Kiev. We'll take a short break now. More on Ukraine after this.
The Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street in London is open now for indoor drinking and dining, so why not pop in and grab a table? While you're there, be sure to browse our pop-up Monocle shop. And don't forget happy hour, every day from 1600 to 1900. Stop by for a beer, cocktail, or a glass of wine. We'd love to see you.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. I am joined now in the studio by today's panel, which is Monocle 24's Marcos Hippi, Carlotta Ribello and Tom Edwards. What I wanted to do in this part of the show was talk about Ukraine as it is being seen from our respective home nations. And I will start with you, Tom. Obviously, the United Kingdom, which you are representing right here, it has been right out in front of this. Liz Truss, the UK Foreign Secretary, is embarking for Kiev imminently. Are you, speaking as a British person, completely confident that that is going to sort everything out?
Liz Truss, you mean?
Yeah.
Probably not, just to err on the side of caution.
Worth a try.
I think what's quite interesting here is there's an interesting sort of twin narrative about the UK's involvement in this piece. On the one hand, I think it's a pretty good moment in soft and hard power terms for the UK in terms of Ukraine, in terms of support, in terms of some of the rhetoric around it.
Well,
you've heard from people on this very theme.
We have heard from a Ukrainian journalist in Kiev already earlier in the week who may have been gilding the lily somewhat for a British radio station, and it's presumably substantially British audience, but he did say the phrase "God save the Queen" has passed into the local vernacular.
And yet, interestingly, if you look, say, slightly further afield, if we go transatlantic, for example, look, this is the front page of the Times of London this morning. US sounds alarm over Russian cash in London. This is a refrain familiar to readers of British newspapers. It's definitely a familiar refrain to readers of the excellent satirical organ Private Eye, which has absolutely gone to task on this. There's a tsunami of dirty money that flows mm-hmm. into London. In the US, it's known apparently in law enforcement circles as London Grad, because it's a laundromat for dirty Russian money. And I think the point which a lot of frustrated observers, including those who are trying to prosecute meaningful cases stateside, is it's all well and good, doing some mealy-mouthed rhetoric. It's all well and good providing limited hardware, you know, for the sort of the sharp end of the conflict. It's meaningless if you don't shut down the flow of money. And just to give you one figure, there are UK government estimates that the amount of corrupt money flowing into the UK is £100 billion sterling per annum.
That seems like quite a lot.
Granted, not all of it's coming from Russia, but a very significant proportion is. And I think that the interesting dilemma here for the Johnson administration, which maybe has other things on its plate, is can you marry up your rhetoric with meaningful action on shutting down the money supply?
Marcus, to bring you in, your home country, Finland, has a certain amount in common with Ukraine's present predicament in that Finland obviously has had to get used to living next door to invoke the usual metaphor, this large, angry, volatile and territorially acquisitive bear. Is there anything from Finland's experience that Ukraine could usefully adopt?
I think it may be too late. You know, Finland obviously for a very long time tried to be somehow in between Russia or Soviet Union and the West, and kind of like not to irritate the Soviet Union or Russia. I think we were in a sense quite lucky that back in the mid 1990s, when we joined the European Union, Russia was too weak to show any aggression. I think that may have been one of the contributing factors why it was so easy for Russia to actually go and for Finland to go and join the European Union. And, you know, we've seen the movement in Ukraine to move towards West, and we see that now that Russia is stronger, you are getting this very, very extremely aggressive reaction. And I think it's still interesting that even though Finland is, we'd like to think we are officially in the West, there is an interesting debate taking place in Helsinki at the moment. You get many of these old school, even younger politicians who are saying that they are not willing to support any military support or any military equipment to Kiev because they don't want to have Finland seen as a part in this conflict. They don't want to take sides. And this is something, you know, Finland's been doing for such a long time. They want to be kind of impartial. But the fact is that Finland is already part of the West. Finland is already a part of the European Union. Finland is rather close to NATO as well. And we're getting some younger voices over there, including one of Finland's top academics, Charlie Salonius-Pasternak, who is working for the Foreign Institute in Finland. He's saying that he's been speaking to many, many officials, and they get really bothered when they're trying to explain the situation, what is happening now and why Finland is so passive. And they always just try not to mention the word Russia, even though it's absolutely impossible. And he's saying that we should be more compassionate. Finland should show more support for Ukraine. This crisis has lasted for over 7 years now, and Finland's support for Ukraine has been close to minimal. And Charlie Salonius-Pasternak, for example, is saying that Finland should realize that we may be in the situation one day when Russia is threatening us, and the world is going to remember how much support we have been offering to the likes of Ukraine.
Point there I do want to follow up, Marcus. You mentioned that Finland joined the EU at a time at which, very arguably, Russia was too weak and disorganized to do anything to stop that from happening. But obviously, one of the things that appears to be agitating Russia now is the prospect of Ukraine one day joining NATO. And Ukraine has been quite upfront in its ambitions in that regard. Indeed, Ukraine's ambitions of joining NATO and the EU are literally written in Ukraine's constitution. You would need, as I understand it, either a referendum referendum or total regime change to do anything to alter that. Why didn't Finland join NATO when possibly it could have at the time?
I think we're asking that question from ourselves at the moment. I think there's a certain level of regret in Finland at the moment that we didn't do it back in the day. But it's the old relationship with of Finland next to the Soviet Union or Russia. We didn't want to irritate Moscow. And that is the main point. And why I'm saying that many people may be regretting now that we didn't join NATO, it's interesting that Russian politicians don't say much about what would happen if Finland were to join NATO one day. But interestingly, in recent weeks in particular, we've been reading from Russian media very aggressive opinions by many influencers, many opinion makers in Russia, saying that if Finland one day joins NATO, they have to understand what they're doing. And the reaction from Russia is going to be aggressive. They have to realize the risk.
Well, let's bring you in, Carlotta, as the designated representative of another EU NATO nation, Portugal. Now, obviously, that is a fair way from the potential theatre of war. But is this playing as a big thing in Portuguese media, in Portuguese politics? Is this something about which Portugal feels like it needs to have an opinion and take a stand?
It's quite interesting because obviously Portugal does not have the diplomatic gravitas of a country like the UK, nor has the issue of having a border with Russia as Marcus Finland has. But there is quite a significant Ukrainian community in Portugal for Portuguese standards. The latest census say that over 44,000 Ukrainian citizens live in Portugal. And this is without counting the ones that have dual nationality. And it has been for many, many years. And Portugal, of course, has to work within the lines of NATO, within the lines of the European Union more than anything. But they were quite quick at commenting on the issue. The Prime Minister, António Costa, despite being quite busy with an election that's happening this Sunday, was very quick in saying that, you know, NATO has asked the Portuguese armed forces to step up military efforts, that they have put together, you know, means like a submarine, some F-16 fighter jets, cargo planes like the C-295 and other transport type of vehicles ready to be deployed as soon as NATO asks for it. So it's not even a case of will they, won't they. As soon as the green light goes, Portugal is ready, which has Portugal's armed forces have throughout the last few years been a bit like that. A lot of peacekeeping missions, a lot of being ready if NATO or the EU so demands it. We heard from the Portuguese foreign minister earlier this week, I believe on Monday or Tuesday, after the meeting of the EU27, the foreign ministers of all the European Union countries. And he was not only towing within the line of the European Union, but also saying, you know, mentioning exactly the Ukrainian community in Portugal, how there are Portuguese citizens living particularly in the Donbass region, and they were already in contact on the issue of removing staff from the embassy in Kiev. Most of the staff are local, so that's not an issue for now, and Portuguese ambassador in Kiev is not moving and it's not going anywhere for now. So for a small country far away from the issue and without the might of the UK, it is quite a big deal. That is still making some waves back home.
Carlotta Ribello, Marco Sippi and Tom Edwards, thank you all for joining us. Returning to the subject of Ukraine, within the last couple of hours, President Volodymyr Zelensky has given a somewhat feisty press conference to foreign journalists in Kiev. Among the points President Zelensky made was to the effect that it is a mistake to think in terms of an imminent or threatened invasion by or conflict with Russia. Russia did invade Ukraine 8 years ago and never left, and the fighting in the Donbass region in Ukraine's east is ongoing. Well, joining me now from Barcelona is Raul Gallego, an award-winning journalist and filmmaker who recently visited the Donbass while filming his documentary series titled Fly on the Wall. While there, Raul spoke to the men and women on the front lines fighting the war as it currently is and preparing for the bigger war, which may still be to come. Raul, first of all, let's talk about when you were last in Ukraine. When were you there and which parts of it were you visiting?
Well, last time I was in Ukraine was November, December. And yeah, went through like different parts in the Donbass region in the front line, so checking what was the situation. And there was a time that there was, for a few months, was already like an escalation of the exchange of fire So yeah, I was like going through different parts in the border in the Ukrainian side.
So when you talk about escalations and exchanges of fire, I think that's a useful thing to get into, because at the moment people are talking about this thing like it's something that hasn't started yet. But there is fighting and there is firing going on. How heavy and how frequent was it?
That was actually the frustration of a lot of the Ukrainian soldiers, that they felt that they were kind of forgotten. That is like they're even saying even in our own country, like, it's a very strange situation, because there is a clear front line for both sides, like fixed positions with all these like trenches that all of us we've seen. Well, you've seen people seen in the pictures that looks like First World War, Second World War. And there is these regulations that it's been in this like the Minsk protocol. It's strange because there is like the you can shoot this caliber of mortar, this caliber of, you know, like weapon. And you cannot shoot farther than this from the front line. So it is this very strange like war zone that that you can be there, spend the day, and then when you get out and you drive certain kilometers far from the war zone, you're going to be safe. Of course, like both sides are blaming, but breaking up the ceasefire. But if you everybody can go to the, you know, like the website of the OSCE, you know, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, that they do the missions to monitor the ceasefire. And you can see that even now, every day, there is like a breaking of the ceasefire.
And was there much talk among the Ukrainian soldiers about the prospect of, you know, a proper large-scale land war with Russia and what that might be like? Did they talk about that with confidence, with nervousness, with trepidation? What?
That's a story I did when I was there. Because you see the majority of the reports, like, you know, journalists go there and always the official voice, you know, the first interview that they will tell you is like, we are ready to fight. And yeah, everybody's ready to fight. But then when you spend more time, you know, and you talk and they open to you, that of course, nobody wants an escalation. Nobody wants to be in the front lines. They were telling me like, look, it's cold, it's dangerous, it's scary. My friend got killed. War is horrible, you know. War is the association of death. People die. It's just scary. Like in the story that I did for Al Jazeera, they were telling like how at night the hands were shaking because they were afraid from the bombing. How was like nerve-wracking to be just waiting on the trenches. There was a big frustration because they were saying like it's been a long time that we've been here, and there is no clear orders of what is going to happen. We're just going to give up that part of Donbass, or we're going to try to recover, or what is going to happen? And they felt that they were just there waiting and in a dangerous situation. And they were really scared. Like when we were in the trenches, they were like always reminding me, look, be careful. Look, if you don't put up your head too up, you know, because out of the trenches, because at the end of the day, like nobody wants war, you know? Especially those that have experienced it or are experiencing. Like one of the commanders was telling me, why Russia wants thousands of deaths? You know, if this happened, like people is going to die. Why they need that?
Raul Gallego, thank you for joining us. And finally, on today's show, among the next acts in the diplomatic theatrics around Ukraine is, as we were discussing earlier, a visit to Kiev by UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. Truss is not the only person currently packing their winter wear for such a journey. I was joined earlier at Midori House by Ukraine's ambassador to the UK, Vadim Prishtyko. I began by asking what he was anticipating from his own imminent trip home.
I will be at all the meetings which Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs will have in Ukraine. And Liz Truss, it's not a big secret, I guess, will see Minister of Foreign Affairs and the President of Ukraine. And she will have a day to go around Ukraine and see some of other places. We will see what she might come up with and what are the new negotiations, new stage. We are so happy that we're already, you know, in a quite a, you know, deep cooperation, including the weapons being provided to us. This is a very new stage of our cooperation. And I hope that at this particular visit, we will be able to open up a new page of our cooperation.
Is there perhaps, ironically, all things considered, a possible opportunity here for Ukraine to, despite what Russia clearly wants, to actually knit Ukraine more closely into the defense and diplomatic architecture of Europe?
That's, I believe, the strategic mistake of Russians. They believe by this threat to kill us, they will somehow ignite, you know, subservience on the Ukrainian side. And that's a great miscalculation. Over the 7 years of war, we haven't just changed nothing in our direction. We were still going towards Europe and generally NATO and European Union and Europe. But we're actually getting closer and closer with each other in every day. Even our economy is just showing quite a result already, meaning that in the middle of war, we still, and half of the conversations we will have with your Secretary of State will be actually not about war, but about our normal strategic operation. We managed to raise our trade 62% over the last year. So there are other things we are doing, we're doing with UK right now and the rest of the world. We are just normal nation trying to survive with a bigger and quite aggressive neighbor.
I mean, on the subject of that big and quite aggressive neighbor, obviously there has been a huge diplomatic outreach by Ukraine towards the West. What's your understanding of what actual diplomatic conversation, if any, is going on between Kiev and Moscow?
We are limited right now. We still have diplomatic relations. We still have embassies. We don't have ambassadors, though, for all this, all these years. But our missions are still working, sometimes in very difficult, extremely difficult conditions. In some periods of time, we had to bring all the members of families, all the diplomats within the walls of the embassy. Sometimes we had to send our nationals because they've been threatened working in Moscow and other places where our consulates are operating right now. But wouldn't you believe, but we still have to maintain our services and our channels of communications open.
That was Vadim Prashtyko, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Kingdom, speaking to me earlier here at Midori House. We will hear from the ambassador again tomorrow on a special live edition of the Foreign Desk, taking an extended look at the Ukrainian crisis. That's midday GMT tomorrow, 1400 in Kiev, 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C., and anytime you like after that from your preferred podcast provider. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panelists today, Marco Sippi, Carlotta Ribello, and Tom Edwards. Also to Monocle's Paige Reynolds and Chris Chermak in Kiev. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. That'll be 2000 in Kiev, 1800 here in London, and 10 a.m. in San Francisco. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.